A very happy Saturday afternoon to everyone out there. Sunny skies. It was cloudy here just a moment ago downtown, but the sun has opened up again. I hope you're having a great Saturday afternoon. Tell you what, we have got Let's Get Legal coming up in just a few moments. Sitting across from me is John Hagee. We're going to talk estate planning, the importance of planning early, when you should start focusing on that. We also got some folks talking about your auto insurance, if you've got the right auto insurance. Do you even know what kind of auto insurance you have? I don't think I do. We'll answer some of those questions and plenty of yours coming up on Let's Get Legal on WGN. Well, a very pleasant Saturday afternoon, everyone. 3:10 here on WGN. Boy, I hope you're having a great weekend. I hope you're enjoying the sunshine, getting some time to relax. And let's learn a few things along the way, too. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. A couple guests we got coming up a little bit later. We're going to be talking to James McGing and Michael Miller. And all the things that we don't know about our own auto insurance policy. Feel free to go run to your glove box and take a look and see if you can find yours. And let's find out if you're as covered as you think you are. And I am going to be the first in line to figure that out. A little bit later in the show, we'll talk to Ray Kaplan as well. She's got they got some incredible examples of ways that she has saved so many people money on their student loans and how to structure it correctly. Got some great examples here today. We'll talk with Ray in a little bit. And also, Laura Nierreiter is going to join us. Illinois becoming the first state to officially sign off on interrogation techniques with kids under 18. Detectives no longer allowed to lie to them. And this was a bipartisan bill that passed through the House and the Senate here in Illinois and signed by Governor Pritzker. We're going to break down a little bit about what that means and why she thinks. She works over at Northwestern Law School as part of the wrongful convictions part of that school, and she's going to talk a little bit about why that's great here. But our first guest today is attorney John Hagee from Walkner Law Firm. John, a pleasure to talk with you.
You as well. Thank you for having me.
So you primarily do estate planning, and it's you and your wife running the law firm together.
That's right. So my wife, Corinne, and I are law partners and obviously married, so we work and live together, which brings its own challenges and, yeah. and wonderful opportunities as well. So Corinne grew up in Glenview and knew Jim Walkner's children, grew up roughly all the same age. And then when Jim was looking to retire, she and I came on board, and we've really enjoyed it.
I imagine having the roots in the community has helped you guys, and not only obviously have clients that you work with, but a lot of trust there between you and the folks that you work with.
Well, we like to think so. We're trustworthy people. We're your attorneys. So we trade in matters of being truthful and honest with all. So, and you know, having a broad background of the Chicago area, and you know, and I've been here myself since the early 90s, it does help. And we meet a lot of people. We meet a lot of people through our kids' sports, through the church, volunteer opportunities. Corinne's very involved with a lot of women's issues. So it's helpful.
Imagine also with estate planning or any field of law, each state has their own unique little laws and rules and regulations. Having someone with a breadth of knowledge of those specifically can help someone plan their estate.
Oh, right. So that is kind of an oddity still that the states are so different. The overall structures of trusts and wills, you know, those concepts are the same everywhere. But how they come into play in each state is a little different. You know, in Illinois, for instance, and most of the eastern states, you know, these things have to be written. You know, you might have seen things on TV about having a video will or something like that. Well, those aren't applicable in Illinois, but in other states they might work.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's important to hire a local attorney who obviously is knowledgeable of the local laws.
No TikTok video will here in Illinois?
not yet. I guess, maybe we'll see later.
Yeah, exactly. Let's start first with a very broad question. This is kind of me asking, I imagine a lot of listeners too. When should someone start planning for estate planning? Like, what age is it? Is it when you have kids? Is it when the moment you're out of college? Like, talk us through when someone should start to consider that.
Well, in general, I think a good rule of thumb might be 10 years ago. And the yeah. second best time to start planning is tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's at different stages in life. There's different concerns. You know, obviously, when you first have children, you've got to get something in place. If for nothing else, it to designate where the children would go should you and your spouse both pass away unexpectedly. And it is unexpectedly. But it's important to have a plan, because once it's too late, it's too late.
Right.
And then that's also probably the best time to get serious about setting up an estate plan as well, with a trust. A lot of young people don't want to do that. It's a little bit further down the line. It's understandable, mm-hmm. but you've got to at least protect your kids and have that set up, as well as protecting your spouse, to make sure your spouse is the beneficiary of your things, and it doesn't, or if you're not married, the person you're with is the beneficiary and it doesn't go somewhere else. So having a plan is key. And as you get older, it becomes more and more important. Mm-hmm. So there isn't really like a check in at 25 and 65. You need to check in often on that.
I think a lot of people, especially when they're young, they obviously think, and for the most part, they're right, nothing bad is going to happen to me, and God willing, nothing will. I think as you get later and later, you start to become overly concerned and almost worried. It's like going to the dentist or the doctor. If you haven't gone for a while, you start to feel guilty about it, like, oh, I've missed something. Do you think that's what a lot of people have hesitancy for talking to you about?
I think a lot of people put it off for various reasons, but that's certainly part of it. We're in the business of helping people. That's why Quinn and I do this. Mm-hmm. We want to help people make sure they don't have problems later. So I would never be embarrassed or feel guilty about not doing it. It's important that you just come in and get it done. And I think when people do, generally they feel better.
Yeah.
And that's very rewarding for us, to help people.
So even if someone hasn't done much of anything, I mean, I really feel like people want to feel like they are not going to be judged when they walk in the door. You guys are happy to help anyone in any state.
Any state in terms of mental state not a state of Illinois, but
right. Yes.
Yeah. So, of course, that's our job. Everything is confidential. Everything is between the client and ourselves. We have seen it all, I think, for the most part. So I would never feel that, someone's situation that they should be ashamed or embarrassed about coming in.
For sure. All right. More with John Heggie from Wachner Law Firm in just a little bit. WachnerLawFirm.com. That's WOCHNER LawFirm.com. More with John after this on Let's Get Legal here on WGN. John Hansen here, joined by attorney John Heggie from Wachner Law Firm. We've been talking about estate planning. And John, I think that there might be a lot of people out there that say, I don't have an estate. Great. This estate sounds like this grand term.
Sure.
Oh, I have many acres up somewhere. Right. Everyone's got an estate, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that we'd really like to get across to people. Like, yeah, you're right. You don't have to live in the English countryside and have a title to have an estate. Everyone does. If you own any real estate, and you need an estate plan. Because if we don't have an estate plan and you've got assets that total over $100,000, now that's gross.
Mm-hmm.
So if you own a home, even if you've got a huge mortgage on it, it's still an estate over $100,000. That has to go to probate. Unless you create an estate plan that helps you avoid probate.
And what is probate for those that are listening?
So probate is a legal process. In essence, we've all heard about the terrible probate cases that happen where, somebody famous passed and they had 18 wills or no wills or whatever might have happened. But in reality, it's mostly the time it follows a very set of rules that the judge will enforce and say where your things go. So basically, it's giving legal title to other people of someone who has passed away of their things. It's also the time where creditors make claims on the estate. So, we were talking about real estate a moment ago. So if someone owned a house and maybe they had a little bit of equity in it,
mm-hmm.
but as they got older, they had to utilize some state services, maybe they had some credit card debt or something like that. Well, as soon as they pass away, that house doesn't automatically go to their children
right.
or their spouse. It would go to their spouse, but it doesn't go to their children
mm-hmm.
because the creditors are going to come in and they're going to want that equity. So, that's even on a low end of someone's net worth, what they need to be concerned with, which is a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
They need to have plans. Then there's all kinds of tools that we can help to avoid to make sure that those those that asset, that house or real estate would pass to where they would want it to go. And then, of course, on the other end of that, you know, someone who's just been working their whole life, they're heading into retirement, they're starting to see like, oh, you know, we've got a little more than we thought, or we have more than we thought we would at this point. You know, that's very important to protect that. You know, the taxation issue in Illinois is real. The federal limit is very high. The tax limit in Illinois is lower, but it still exists. So with planning, you can avoid taxes for the most part. And, it, you know, people who, whether you're on the high end or the low end of the spectrum, you've got to make a plan. And that's what we can help you with.
When you mention the taxes, it's not a matter of you're not trying to finagle anything. You're just using the laws that exist and educating people and putting places where they need to be. Whereas if you just kind of leave it to probate or chances, it's going to go, you're going to miss out on those opportunities.
You know, that's, John, you're absolutely right. There is a system in place, a legal system in place to avoid these bad things, whether it be taxes, whether it be losing assets to creditors, whether it be having children fighting, having cousins fighting, you know, having all sorts of different opinions. This system exists. Our justice isn't perfect, but we've got a pretty good start on things. So we can set up a plan to help help people avoid any of those problems.
That's great. There's obviously a lot of perils for not planning. You kind of touched on one, and I always hate bringing it up because we love to think that we love all of our siblings and that everything is peaceful. But the reality of the situation is families are complicated. There's, even if it's not huge disagreements, there's disagreements that come across when dealing with the loss of loved ones or trying to figure out with an estate. Planning ahead of time, getting everything down on paper, I think is not only a good thing just for peace of mind, but it can also be a piece of family sort of thing. Like, hey, this is out of your control.
Right.
This is what we've done ahead of time.
Yeah, very much so. So, you know, someone passes away, their family is grieving, they've got to clean up this legal mess, and they might have disagreements about what, you know, grandpa wanted or didn't want. And, you know, those might be, you know, those are each other's truths. You know, they're not necessarily malicious.
Right.
But it's just that without a plan spelling it out, it's up to interpretation. And, you know, the old line, you know, it's not about the money. Well, sometimes it's not. You know, people really are, get feelings hurt. And whereas if you spell it out ahead of time, it makes things much, much smoother.
Right. And I think a lot of families are sitting there listening and saying, well, we're not like the Jerry Springer show. We're going to be fine when this moment comes. But you mentioned there's emotional attachment to things. There's emotional attachments. And maybe there was not a consideration for that. So when someone goes to you to start planning their estate, let's say they've gotten to that step. They know they need to do this. What does it involve? Does it involve do you have a conversation with them saying, lay out everything that you have, you think you have, or you might end up having, and let's talk through it?
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, we have a free consultation because we need to know everything about their situation, and then what their goals are, and then we have, you know, discussion and set up on a plan, and then, you know, we're able to give them a rate for that. Generally, it's a fixed fee.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on, you know, what kind of plan that they have, but yeah, we wouldn't want to ever put any obstacles to someone calling or coming in to have a conversation. You know, here's my concerns. What should I be concerned about? Here's what I have. Here's what I want to have. Here's, you know, those types of conversations are key to forming a good plan.
I imagine you have, I mean, obviously it's all confidential, but you have probably examples of people that maybe there were things that we didn't realize needed to be litigated or planned for ahead of time that can really cause some peril if it isn't thought about ahead of time.
Right. And everything is, of course, confidential, like you said, but it's clear to say real estate is a big tripwire. Even, you know, people think that they have things covered because they maybe put it in a land trust in the 90s or something like that. Real estate drives probate a lot. So as do other assets, you know, banking accounts where you didn't title it or name a beneficiary, savings accounts, you know, anything like that. So that's why it's important to have a sit down and really think about what's there.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask also, like, if you're in your 30s and you say, well, I don't want to plan right now because I'm going to have to just come back every 5 years and write a whole new and start this process from scratch. Are you able to work with someone and say, hey, look, okay, we've got your plan now. We'll make addendums, I don't even know what you would call it, to change it as it goes. This isn't a restart the whole process every 5 years.
Correct. Yeah. So that's the beauty of it. You know, whether you go a trust or a will, You can change the rules whenever you want, and mm-hmm. you don't have to change the whole thing. Particularly with a trust, once a trust exists, we don't ever change the name of that trust. So once you create a trust and you open up your accounts in that trust name, you don't have to start the process over in 5 years and go back and do all of that work again. It's just a one-time thing.
I love hosting this show because I get to ask really dumb questions. Can you tell us what the difference is between a will and a trust?
Certainly. So a will is, you know, like a plan on where you want your things to go. It still requires probate in Illinois under most circumstances. And the judge will look at that will and, you know, unless someone challenges the will or, you know, someone was not in the right mental state when they wrote it, the judge will 99.9% of the time follow the wishes of the deceased. But it still requires probate, which is a little bit of an expensive process. It takes at least 6 months. Versus if you have a trust and your trust owns your things, you're the beneficiary of the trust, you're the trustee of the trust, so you get the benefits and you say how things are done. So it really doesn't change your day-to-day, but you don't technically own it. So when you pass away, the trust has a set of rules as to where those assets go. And then the court isn't involved because you as a person didn't own assets in excess of $100,000. Your trust did.
It sounds like trusts are more what I would want to go with, but are there disadvantages to trust too? I mean, I imagine it's a choice between the two of those.
Well, it's, you know, obviously case by case,
right?
But yes, trusts are much, much better than a will in most cases.
Mm-hmm. And powers of attorney, is that a whole separate plan or?
No, that's part of an estate plan overall.
Okay.
And you got to have it. You got to have a healthcare power of attorney, someone who can make decisions for you when you can't, and if there's a health emergency, and a property power of attorney, someone who can make decisions and do things for you and involving financial institutions when either you don't want to, or, you know, perhaps you're incapacitated, or you know, or you're just tired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. That happens sometimes too.
For sure. There's a lot of consideration. We only got about a minute left. Right. I just want to make sure that, you know, again, we talked about this a little bit ago. When you hear estate, you think, you must own all this sort of stuff to even approach a lawyer like you. No, I mean, you probably have clients running the gamut of someone that has just a few things, a home, which is great, or has many things. And there's no discrimination between who is better at planning than others. You probably deal with all sorts of clients.
Right. So yeah, we run the spectrum, and unfortunately, the legal system doesn't discern either.
Right.
And so generally, if you have a smaller estate and you don't have a plan, you're going to pay more of a price in terms of emotion and actual cost than if you have a larger estate.
That's great.
So it's important to plan.
Yeah, for sure. John, this has been eye-opening. Thanks for joining us here today. Oh,
thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
John Heggie from the Walker Law Firm. You can head to walkerlawfirm.com. Talk to John and his wife. That's wonderful,
right?
Is that? A husband and wife. How rare is that in your line of work? A husband and wife law firm.
Well, I don't particularly know any others, but I pretty much just stick to my own law firm.
So. You do your own thing. You got enough to worry about. Thanks, John. We appreciate
it. Thank you, John.
This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I figure that my job on this show is to ask all the dumb questions that I have. I'm sure some of our listeners do too. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention how little I know about my auto insurance policy before we start this next segment. Joining us, attorneys Michael Miller and James McGing, personal injury attorneys from the law firm of Miller McGing. Gentlemen, thanks for coming in here today.
You know, we want to thank you for having us. This is really a privilege. The studio is absolutely gorgeous. And we'd also like to thank the ISBA for putting this on, the Illinois State Bar Association. We think it's a tremendous program, and we're happy to be a part of it today.
Yeah. Pleasure to be here today. Yeah. Thank you.
And Jim, you were a judge for many, many years. I imagine a show like this and others that we have here at WGN Karen Conti tomorrow, the more people, our listeners, can be educated about all sorts of things, the better off we're going to be.
Absolutely. There's great outreach through the courts and through the bar associations, but the more knowledge that's put out there to the public, it's better for them. They can understand their situation, what repercussions are, and what we're going to talk about today is going to hit home with most people.
Boy, so I bought my auto insurance a couple of years ago. I lumped it with home, and I saw that it was going to be cheaper than what I had before, so I signed on the dotted line. Comes out of my checking account every month. I couldn't even tell you how much it is. Michael, do you think that's what most people do?
I think that's what almost everyone does, based on my experience, and that's the biggest mistake you can actually make as a consumer. You'd be surprised at how many situations that I've run into. I've been practicing for 34 years, doing exclusively personal injury, where people find themselves involved in a fairly serious accident, mm-hmm. and it turns out that the other driver has no insurance or has very little insurance. And one of the things we want to talk about here today a little bit is that Illinois only requires liability insurance in the amount of $25,000 per person mm-hmm. and $50,000 per occurrence. That's what's called state minimum insurance. And there's lots of drivers out there cruising around with the $25,000 $50,000 or no insurance at all. So how do you protect yourself?
Right.
And that's what we want to talk about here a little bit today.
Do you think that it's because a lot of people, they know they have to have it legally to drive, so they check that box, and then they just kind of assume, like we all do, optimistically speaking, nothing's ever going to happen to me?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people talk about that they have full coverage, and it's something that they might talk about with their insurance agent or a broker. But full coverage doesn't necessarily mean in the insurance industry what the consumer thinks it is. And they really don't find out until they're in that situation. They've had an accident, and sometimes a serious accident, and then they call us. And that's the first time that they're looking at their what we call the deck page, and they're looking at what their coverage actually is.
So they look at the page that they should have been looking at on day one when they signed it, and now you're looking at it on one of the most stressful days of your life.
Exactly.
So what sorts of insurances are typical out there? You mentioned this minimal insurance. There's a lot of
right.
different terms. I think this is why people get lost
right,
in the
exactly.
weeds.
Right, exactly. It's a maze of different terms, and it's actually not that complicated.
Okay.
That's what we want to get out there to your listeners today, John.
Okay.
Because, you know, if they check their policies and they talk to their agents and they're educated about it, they can protect themselves and they can protect their families. So, you know, your typical policy, you know, contains underinsured motorist coverage.
Okay.
Uninsured motorist coverage and medical payment coverage and liability coverage. And you can also have collision, you know, if you have a fairly late model car, you know, to cover your cost if there's a serious accident and your car is damaged or totaled. Mm-hmm. But the underinsured motorist and the uninsured motorist are the absolute keys because those protect you. Those protect your family in the event that you're involved in a motor vehicle accident with another driver that has no insurance or state minimum insurance. So that sits on top of their insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So what I advise every client that I talk to is to purchase at least $250,000, $500,000 underinsured and uninsured motorist. And that gives you 10 times the protection of the state minimum.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
For a policy like that, I mean, if you break that out over a year, how much more are you paying on the front end?
That's the thing. It's very inexpensive, and most people don't know that. For several hundred dollars per year, you could increase your coverage by a factor of 10 times. And for a few hundred dollars, you'll sleep better at night.
So that's, I think a lot of people say, I have insurance. That covers my body. That covers what happens to me in my car. Who cares what the other driver has? They may not realize that going forward. So for a couple hundred extra dollars a month, and that's where the relationship with you.
$100
a year. Excuse me. Yes,
right.
A year. That's where the relationship with you guys comes in, too, because if I'm in a serious crash, I need a personal injury attorney like you guys to help me on out. You are going to be able to go further if I have better insurance, correct?
Absolutely, especially in terms of what Mike's talking about, the underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage. We have numerous situations that we have seen over the course of both of our careers, both as private attorneys and even when I was a judge, where people are severely injured in an accident, but their underinsured coverage or they're uninsured in that situation is insufficient to help them to be made whole again in terms of their damages. And Mike can talk about some of those specific situations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you a story of a recent case that just illustrates this perfectly.
Well,
I think
we need to hear examples.
Yeah, because
I feel like again, we're all like, "Oh, we'll be fine. Not going to happen to me. I'm sure I'm okay."
Exactly. I mean, unfortunately, I represent a woman that was struck by a drunk driver.
Mm.
It was a third time DUI.
Oh, jeez.
And this particular gentleman had no liability insurance. And unfortunately, her injuries were very serious. She had severe leg fractures, needed an operation. In fact, she had to be airlifted from the scene of the accident to the nearest trauma center. And she had extensive rehabilitation in a rehabilitation center. And we found out, I had to deliver the news to her that the other party had no liability coverage. So I asked her the question. I said, what is your coverage? What is your uninsured motorist coverage? And she looked at the coverage, and it was $25.50 state minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was very, very upset that she had not known because she thought she was buying full coverage, quote unquote,
right.
when she talked to her agent.
Right.
And so, you know, the message I'd like to deliver to your listeners out here today is that they have the opportunity this weekend to look at what Judge McGing said, the declaration page, to see what the limits are on their uninsured and underinsured, because that's what protects them. And then call their agent this week. Call their agent on Monday and up those limits, because that's how you protect yourself in the event of a – nobody wants to have an accident, but they happen all the time. And mm-hmm. when they do, you have to protect yourselves.
And to protect their family members, their loved ones also.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that you got to think ahead on these sorts of things. I feel like, you know, we all have our blind spots when it comes to insurance specifically, because, again, we don't assume something's going to happen. What about, like, if I'm like, okay, I may not pay that much for my auto insurance, maybe I don't have the best coverage, but I've got great medical insurance with my employer. I'm good, right?
Not.
Okay.
You know, medical.
You're Mr. Bad News here today, Michael.
Well, this is all about education, John.
Right,
okay,
right.
This is all about telling the people of Chicago what they need to know
right.
in order to avoid catastrophe and tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
So, the medical insurance is all fine and good, except for there's a few problems with it. One, they have copays. Another, they have deductibles. And then we have the out-of-network situations mm-hmm. where you go to a doctor or you want to go to a doctor that's not in the network of the health insurance plan. So,
or in an emergency, you're taken somewhere where you're not in the plan.
I can tell you about Medevac bills that exceed $40,000 or $50,000 for the helicopter ride. Now, that's a very unusual situation.
Right.
But health insurance carriers do not like paying those.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them even exclude things like that. So what I tell my clients is to buy medical pay insurance on their auto policy. And most people have between $1,000 and $5,000 in medical pay insurance. And it is unbelievable that you could get $25,000 or $100,000 for a very small premium.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to look at that as well.
Yeah, we got to take a quick commercial break here in a moment. But as soon as you guys walked in, I could tell you were old friends. I just didn't realize quite how old of friends you are. We'll get to that and plenty more here on Let's Get Legal after this on WGN. John Hansen here on Let's Get Legal. It's 3:47 on this Saturday afternoon. We're talking about auto insurance with personal injury attorneys Michael Miller and Jim. Do you prefer Jim or James? I forgot to ask you.
Jim is good.
Oh, go yeah. Judge. How about
yeah.
Judge McGing?
Former judge.
Yeah.
Former judge.
But don't we get to call you Judge your whole life then?
I mean, some people do. It's nice.
And yeah. he can still marry people too. That's
the
other thing.
Marry people.
Oh,
I've done hundreds of weddings. So.
Hundreds. You're the go-to guy for people?
A lot of judges do it. You know, it's a way to give back to people.
Yeah,
but he doesn't charge.
Yeah. You shouldn't have said that on air. When we give out the phone number or the website, they're going to be calling for other reasons.
No, I do it for people I know.
Yeah.
So.
You guys have a great story, you two together. It was the first day of high school, right?
We met the first day of high school, St. Patrick High School on the northwest side. Shout out to the Shamrocks out there.
There you go.
Shamrocks. And interestingly enough, it was Spanish class, the first level of Spanish. And there's a lot of last names that start with M, right?
Right.
So Miller, McGing, two rows of M's. And this gentleman sat right next to me in first year of high school on the first day of Spanish class when we became instant friends.
Wow. And that has lasted. I mean, obviously you guys have done different things for a while, and now your paths have converged.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, we started the law firm back in the early 90s, actually. And then I'll let Jim talk a little bit about his career, so to speak. But he came back to me, which is the most important thing, John. He came back to me in 2019. He couldn't leave me.
Yeah.
So I'll let Jim talk a little bit about what he's done.
Yeah.
So we practiced together, and then I went full-time as a legal counsel for the Cook County Sheriff. And still had my law practice because it was just a civil practice. And then I went on the bench in 2006 as a judge. And I worked in a bunch of different divisions, but I finished my career in the law division. I sat in the jury section hearing these types of cases, personal injury, wrongful death, medical negligence cases. And then I was a supervising judge in the what's called the tax and miscellaneous section of that division. And then I came back in 2019, the end of 2019, I left and came back to practice with Michael, and it's been going well, and people are calling us, and we're helping people, which is the most important thing.
On the northwest side of the city in Edison Park, which is a wonderful neighborhood.
Oh,
if you've never been there,
mm-hmm.
great restaurants, great food, great people, and we're right in downtown Edison Park.
Does your experience, do you think, you know, having sit in those jury boxes, you say, I mean, that must guide a lot about what you do and the advice that you give to people that come to you?
It does. Having done so many jury trials, and then the judge gets to spend a little more time with the jurors than the attorneys once the trial is over. You can't have any conversations with the jurors without the attorneys present during the trial. But afterwards, I would go into the jury room. I would talk with them. They would ask me questions. There were some things they asked for explanations on, but I also saw some of their frustrations sometimes with trials, and if things became repetitive, and sometimes if it was a slow moving trial, they would let me know. And so I knew their frustrations, and it was part of what you did as a judge to try and you know, make sure the jury is your priority and that you're moving the case along, and that the attorneys are moving their witnesses and the evidence along also.
Yeah, it's important. I just would want experienced folks like you that have that courtroom experience on both sides of it. I think that just sort of helps, because at the end of the day, you guys are just trying to help some people on their worst days or their worst circumstances.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's pretty much what we see. And, you know, my mother always taught me, you take a bad situation and you try to make the best you can out of it.
Yeah.
And you're trying to turn something bad into something, you know, at least, if not good, you know, reasonable. And that's what we like to think we do for, you know, victims of personal injury accidents. You know, we find them in a state where it's, like you said, John, the worst day of their life. And we try to guide them from that day to the end result. And sometimes that journey takes many years, and sometimes it's not so long. But, you know, we like to know that, like them to know that we care about what happens to them.
Right.
And we care about their case, and we want to get the best result.
As we were talking about at the beginning of the segment about auto insurance and having the right coverage, I just want to make sure we hammer this point home. Because the auto insurance that I have, if something happens, it doesn't just help my bottom dollar in that certain things are covered or not. It can help me when I come and talk to you guys to a huge factor. I mean, it makes a gigantic difference for just a couple extra $100 a year, right?
It is night and day, John. You're exactly right. You know, if someone gets involved in an accident where there's little or no insurance, and then they have little or no insurance, there's very little we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the problem. And so they can help themselves by checking their, what's called, like Judge McGing said, their declaration page this weekend, see what kind of coverage they have, call their agent and tell them that they want at least $250, $500. They also sell $100, $300, which I used to recommend in the old days, but things are so expensive now. Medical bills, child, you know, care. I now recommending for the past 5 or 10 years $250, $500.
So you just call your agent and you say, I want $250, $500, and they'll know what that means.
They'll exactly know what that means.
They will.
Okay.
And they want it across the board.
Yeah. If you can notice, I'm writing detailed notes right now.
You see that?
For my call on Monday, and I imagine a lot of listeners will. And liability, right?
Well, when you buy the liability $250, $500, then you're also going to buy the uninsured and motorist and the underinsured motorist. So it's across the board, $250, $500. And that's pretty adequate protection for most situations.
Mm-hmm.
There are other types of insurance, you know, umbrella policies that are good for high net worth individuals or business owners. And as the name implies, an umbrella policy sits on top of your auto policy and your homeowner's policy and can provide coverage up to $1 million or more.
Mm-hmm.
And those are good to get. And again, they're not very expensive. And so it's something, you know, if you're a high net worth individual, if you're a business owner, or if you're just concerned about your assets, even if you're not a high net worth individual, get an umbrella policy. But they generally require that you have $250, $500 underlying
already.
Limits already. Okay. But it's something else to ask your insurance agent about.
Yeah. All right. Last half hour, I learned the difference between a will and a trust. I see a lot in my notes. Liens.
Oh.
It's a word I hear all the time, and I pretend like I know what it is, but I don't. So one of you take a good swing at this one.
Mike can start, and then I'll
start, and I'll let him finish, because that's the way things usually work with us.
Right.
Okay. The judge always gets the last word in every courtroom, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, liens on personal injury cases are something that you really need the help of an experienced attorney to deal with. Because some people think that, okay, my case is settled with the insurance company, everything's all good. But then they realize the insurance company has quote unquote liens on the file. And liens can take so many different forms, and there's been an enormous explosion of the types of liens that can be put on a personal injury case in the last 25 years. You have doctor's liens, you have hospital liens, you have public aid liens, you have Medicare super liens.
Is this money owed to someone?
It's money that's owed back to people because of the medical bills that were incurred in the case.
Okay.
And who paid them. The other liens that we typically deal with are called insurance subrogation liens, where health insurance carrier, like you talked about earlier, John, you know, they pay your medical bills or part of your medical bills. They've got their hand out at the end, and they want their money back from your settlement. And so that gets very complex. And in order to get the optimum amount of money for the client at the end, we have to battle the lien holders.
Okay.
And that's something that I've been doing very successfully for the past 34 years. But what's interesting is that it's even more important now than it ever was, because there's more liens, it's more complex. We've got books devoted to liens and seminars devoted to liens. Mm-hmm. And so it's become a real, I say now, the case begins when it ends.
And when you say battle, you mean try and either negotiate or challenge certain liens as they're not legit or whatever the case may be?
Yeah, John. I mean, good old-fashioned negotiation is probably the best thing, okay? That's always, usually the best thing is the oldest thing and the thing the most comfortable to you. But we also have very powerful laws in Illinois. We have a law called the Healthcare Services Act, Lien Act, and that actually helps us compress these liens into a portion of the settlement, mm-hmm. so that our clients can benefit. I mean, we do this for the people, the clients.
Right.
We don't do it for the lien holders. We understand they have to get paid, but we don't do this for them. We do this for our clients.
Yeah.
And I don't think that anyone generally in the public thinks about that if you have health insurance and it pays for your hospital bills and your doctor bills and maybe your rehab after a serious accident, that they're going to come back and seek reimbursement for what they paid. Your health insurance company often has a lien on your settlement for those monies back. So it's complicated, and that's why people need to reach out to an attorney. It's what we do every day. It's part of what we do for our clients.
I couldn't pass the LSAT, but I'm getting closer, gentlemen. Thanks so much. Judge, I want really quickly before we go, I just want to give a shout-out. Your son, a lifelong Blackhawks fan.
Yes.
And he now what? He just had some good news come his way.
Well, he grew up – My kids are all from the city of Chicago, grew up here. I had three sons who played college hockey, one at the University of Illinois, one at Arizona State, and the youngest one played at Western Michigan. He was captain, and last year was a first-team All-American. He was drafted by, the St. Louis Blues in 2018, and signed with them last year when their playoffs were canceled.
Uh-huh.
And this year, they had their camp in January, and then he was assigned to the American Hockey League, the AHL. So this year, the Blues and Vancouver, the Vancouver Canucks, shared a team in Utica, New York. So
yeah.
He was out in New York. It was a rough season. In the middle of the season, 5 weeks they were off because of players, having COVID. And he'll be heading back to St. Louis in September for their development camp and then their NHL camp.
Well, we wish him well, even if
he's part
of the Blues organization. Gentlemen, a real pleasure chatting with you guys. MillerMcGing.com is a great place to go. MillerMcGing.com. I see a phone number here, 773-467-8000 for people to reach you. Guys, it's great to get to know you, and thanks for helping folks out and for educating our listeners.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
We appreciate it. Well, a very pleasant Saturday afternoon to you. It's 4:08 here. This is WGN. This is Let's Get Legal, and I'm John Hansen. Of course, all this powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, and we appreciate that. Look, we have got a lot to talk about this hour. Later on, we're going to chat with someone from Northwestern University about a new law, a bipartisan law. I love saying the word bipartisan because it doesn't happen too much anymore, whether it's Springfield or Washington, but a near unanimous law passed saying that police officers or interrogators cannot interrogate or lie to anyone that they're interrogating under the age of 18 to try and coerce them or just to try and get them to confess to a crime. It's a really interesting discussion about why that happened, and we've got someone who knows a lot about that, who has really been advocating for that. That's going to be at 4:30. I'm always excited to talk to Ray Kaplan because you do so well, Ray, explaining to people the real difficult world of student loans. And until we chatted before we went on air here, I didn't realize that you got into it because you were navigating your own world of student loans too.
Oh, absolutely. I had no idea how to handle my own federal student loans, and I just knew that the answers had to be out there. And once I actually found the statute that governs and controls all federal student loans, then it all clicked.
I think that people just assume that either A, the government's going to tell them exactly the way to pay less, which I think a lot of people know that isn't the case, or whatever the bill is, there's nothing you can do about it, right?
Exactly. And that normally is the case when you have private student loans. If you have, let's say you owe on a private student loan or a credit card debt, usually, I mean, the bill's the bill. You have to pay whatever the monthly statement says or more than that. But that's not the case with federal student loans. So for parents listening out there, if you're getting ready to put your kids through school, I mean, most parents, we were talking about this before off the air, they're just worried about getting their kid into the school of choice, right? And then they kind of scramble and figure out how to pay for it after those acceptance letters come in. But what we want to do is put together a roadmap and a strategy so that you know exactly how much you're going to need to take out, who should be the borrower so that you get the lowest monthly payment, and then exactly how much you're going to have to pay after the kids graduate. And there won't be any payments until after the kids graduate. That's the nice thing about federal student loans, and that's what most people don't understand. And there's a lot of confusion out there, and there's a lot of misinformation about student loans, and that's why I'm here to clear up those mistaken ideas out there.
Yeah, because there really is. It's a tough world to navigate. By the way, I just want to make sure everyone knows financialrelief.com for all of this if you have any questions or concerns or need any more information on it. Right before we get to some specific examples, I do want to talk about the CARES Act forbearance, because this is coming up in September. September 30th is when the forbearance borrowers are not required to make payments. That ends September 30th, right?
Right, that expires. So all of your federal student loans that are direct federal student loans have been in forbearance since March 13th, 2020 through September 30th, 2021. That also means that if you have been making payments for these 16 months, you are entitled to a refund of every single penny that you have made on your federal student loans that entire time.
I have a dumb question right off the bat. Forbearance, does that mean you are forgiven for those payments, or is it delays the payment that you have to make?
Exactly. It's like a suspension.
Okay.
And this is a nice one too, because most forbearance during that time, the interest continues to accrue. But this forbearance, no interest has been accruing on your loans. So there's no even downside to calling and getting a refund of all that money that you've been paying mistakenly for the past 16 months.
Right, because you could say, well, I already paid it, whatever, it's gone. But if it's interest-free, get that money in your pocket and pay it that way. Unless you just want to be done with it earlier, or it's a very individual decision.
Right, exactly. But a lot of people don't know that they're entitled to that money back, every single penny. And they'll get the money back into your account in 7 to 10 business days, into your checking account. It actually happens pretty quickly. So that's something that a lot of people didn't know. And the other thing to know is that not all federal student loans were eligible for that kind of forgiveness.
Okay.
They can't be FEL loans, F-F-E-L. They have to be direct federal student loans, which is the majority of federal student loans.
Okay, so everyone should look into that for sure. All right, let's get into a specific example, all right?
Okay.
Let's say typical family, $75,000, and let's say someone works in the public sector, or they both do. Walk us through this sort of situation.
Okay, to give you an idea of how forgiving and flexible the federal statute is that governs federal student loans, let's say you are a family of four. You've got two kids. The mom is a nurse at one of our local hospitals here, and she's making about $75,000 a year. If your kid got into Northwestern and it's about $75,000 a year for tuition now, and you need to take out $150,000 in federal Parent PLUS loans, there will be no payments while your child is in school. And then once your child graduates, she will be eligible, in other words, the mom, for a monthly payment of $294 a month on that entire $150,000 loan balance.
Less than a car payment, it seems like.
Less than a car payment. It's like a cell phone payment, basically.
Yeah, right.
And because she's employed likely in the public sector, so if your hospital's a not-for-profit, like, say, Northwestern or Lutheran General, she will only have to pay for 120 payments, which is 10 years. That means that she will pay back $37,000 on that $150,000 loan balance and the entire balance forgiven, plus all of the interest that accrues over that 10-year period. Now, people think, well, that's great if you're working in the public sector, but what if you work in the private sector? You're still eligible for the same plan. It's just that you pay in longer. So instead of 10 years, it's 20 years. And okay, so fine, you have a $150,000 loan balance. You only pay back $65,000 entire balance forgiven plus all the interest. It just does not get better than that in the world of lending. So federal student loans, people should not be afraid of them. And we walk through in my practice, we walk you through how to do this, who should be the borrower, because it's very important. It shouldn't be necessarily the person, it's not always the person making the least amount of money that should be the borrower. Sometimes it should be who's going to be making the least amount of money when the loans become due.
Interesting, because that circumstance can change.
Absolutely. If one of the parents has a higher pension than the other?
Interesting. So when you take out a federal student loan, do they look at total family income? I mean, like, there's a lot that goes into whether they determine what the rate you're going to get. How does that work?
So the way it works for federal Parent PLUS loans is that they don't care about your income. You can have zero income when you're applying for federal Parent PLUS loans and be approved no problem. They're loosely credit-based. So your credit should be in decent shape when you're applying for your federal Parent PLUS loans. So you don't want to apply if you have just recently filed for a bankruptcy. But even if you have filed for bankruptcy, we can still get you approved for federal Parent PLUS loans. You just might need an endorser, and we can later get that endorser removed through a federal consolidation. So there are ways around it. Even if your credit isn't great, most people will qualify for federal Parent PLUS loans. And then your student who's actually attending school will also qualify for their own federal student loans, and they're also eligible for those income-based repayment plans that are similar to the ones that I mentioned. Actually, even better payment terms.
If I am someone who I want to do this plan you're talking about, I'm a nurse, a firefighter, right? Because what other public sectors are covered in this sort of stuff?
Oh, let's see. So firemen, policemen, nurses, doctors, even if you work at the cafeteria at a local hospital or at a local school, or any Northwestern or University of Chicago, any employee, as long as you're full time.
Okay. If you are, let's say, closer to retirement, let's say.
Yes.
And you're not going to, do you have to work the 10 years to be eligible for that?
Right. So for public sector loan forgiveness to apply while you're making those payments, you have to be employed full time. But I have good news. If you are going to retire, sometimes it makes sense to manage the loans, make very low monthly payments, because oftentimes once you have retired, you're eligible to have the entire loan balance forgiven under the TPD discharge application, which is basically an application to have the loans forgiven because you have some sort of medical illness or ailment, even say arthritis. We've had over $2 million in federal loans forgiven under that section of the statute.
Do so many people just go the private loan route because it was either advertised for them or they just, oh, that's easier. I know this bank or whatever the case may be, and just don't even ever look at the federal loans.
Yes, they panic because what will happen is your kid will be qualified for a few thousand dollars and it's a drop in the bucket. And so the parents are searching around for ways to finance this other, you know, $30,000 that they need to come up with. And sometimes you're talking to a financial aid officer at the school who's a kid who doesn't have that much experience. And they say, oh, well, here's a Discover student loan. And I don't mean to pick on Discover. But, you know, here's a private loan application or whatever it is. And so the parents just want to get the funding for their kids to go to school. So they don't really do much. It's kind of a knee-jerk reaction. And that's what we're trying to avoid. We want to plan it out.
Yeah, a knee-jerk reaction that could literally cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh, the difference there is the difference between paying $35,000 over 10 years and paying $150,000 in 10 years.
Okay, yeah, we're just scratching the surface here. Ray Kaplan, obviously you're going to stick around here. We're going to take a quick commercial break. More Let's Get Legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association after this on WGN. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Ray Kaplan is here, and 312-981-7200. Ray will answer any of your questions that you might have. Obviously, specifics are good, right? Because each individual case is so different.
Yes.
And that's why I do love when you provide these examples with all this math, Ray. I got to say, obviously, you know what you're doing. But I think it helps to hear from people that are going from it, because you might say, oh, that's exactly or similar to what I'm going through, too.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of these situations are just very common situations, but you know, there's a big difference between paying $800 a month on a federal student loan and paying $290 a month.
For sure. 312-981-7200. We do have a few texts coming in. Someone wants to know, where does this forgiveness money come from? Sounds like it's coming from everyone else, the taxpayers. What's the point? I can't say forgive me of a mortgage because I'm a fireman, per se. Interesting question. Yeah. Is this a matter of we're taking money from the government, so they're going to have to tax people more?
Absolutely not. So the whole reason that Congress wrote this law was to encourage people to go into the public sector. So there was a strategy here where basically Congress, Senate, and the president eventually who signed it basically said, look, we know that people have to take out a lot of federal student loans in order to go through college. We want to encourage you to go into the public sector, and we're going to help you out by making this payment plan available. And you also have to remember that a lot of people overpay on their federal student loans. Mm-hmm. I see a ton of people who owe $100,000, but they've wound up paying $300,000 over the years. So it works out. A lot of people get forgiveness, but a lot of people overpay. And so in the end, it all kind of balances out. But this is simply the law. And it's kind of the same thing when you go to pay your taxes and file your tax return. You take the deductions that you're entitled to legally because you don't want to leave that money on the table. I mean, you certainly can overpay on your taxes and give some extra money to the government, but I don't recommend it.
No, and that's the thing. It's like when they made the ledger or when they kind of look at the revenue coming in, the expenses going out, and this law was written, they budgeted for people to take the advantage of the system. That is the whole point. It's not like, oh, if you take money out of the piggy bank, someone's got to put something in to make up for that. No, it's already been allocated.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these laws are analyzed by the Congressional Budget Office, and they're debated in this particular, this is under the Higher Education Act, was debated and talked about committees and studied for years before it was passed. So simply, the law is there for your benefit. You might as well take advantage of it.
We have a question from 847 about law school or after postgraduate degrees. Are there federal loans available for that too? Is that a similar structure?
Yes, there are great federal student loans available for that. They are called Graduate Plus loans, and our office helps people all the time figure out how best to handle that and take out those Graduate Plus loans, and also to determine what the payments are going to look like after you graduate and how much forgiveness, if any, you're going to be entitled to.
By the way, we should mention Kaplan Law Firm. Go to financialrelief.com for all this information and to find out more. All right, you had another example here, and I guess I wanted to ask, and this is might relate to the one that you had, but also just in general, you talk about planning ahead of time and how important that is. What about for people that have already have their federal loans and maybe they think that they qualify for something? Is there anything you can do after the fact? Or are you extremely limited?
No, because there are such good payment plans under the statute that most of the time we can lower your payment and lower the overall amount that you are actually required to pay underneath the statute. Again, with federal student loans, it's a different calculus than private loans or credit card debt or anything else. And oftentimes, once you have that figured out, everything else falls into place. If you were, say, having trouble making your mortgage payment or your credit card payment because your federal student loan payment was too high, if we can get that federal loan payment down to, you know, a fifth of what it was sometimes, then everything else falls into place.
And you can, I mean, a fifth of what it was?
Oh, very often. Sometimes payment plans, we see it all the time, are going from $1,500 a month to $0 per month and then actually forgiven. And that's just what the borrower is entitled to under the statute. I know it's hard to believe.
It is.
But it's just the way it works out. And it's not for everybody.
Right.
I mean, obviously, if you're making $500,000 a year, you're not going to be entitled to a $0 monthly payment plan. And I have had those people come into my office and be very disappointed when I tell them you're not entitled to a $0 monthly payment plan. But for most people, there is a way for us to lower the payment and have them pay less overall over a longer period of time.
Right, to spread it out or something like that to help you on out. A great question from the 773. When should parents start that process of Parent Plus loans? Is it when your kid's looking at colleges, junior, senior year, before then?
You can start applying for federal Parent Plus loans the summer before your child is entering in for the fall semester. And you can actually list a few different schools, even if you don't know which which school your child is going to. And then once you have the acceptance letter, then you can make sure that the funds are allocated to the right school. So you can make sure you get that approval so you have that peace of mind even before you know exactly where your child is going to school.
6Rio wants to know, are for federal loans only for public universities and colleges, or can you get federal loans for private university and colleges too?
Most universities and colleges, private included, are also Title IV schools, meaning that they're eligible to get federal funding. So you just have to check, but most of the schools are eligible for it.
312-981-7200. If you got any questions, please get them in. Ray Kaplan does such a great job answering them. And I really think that you mentioned, if we're always taught, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And of course, you're using great, not everyone's going to get, like you said, 1/5 of the payment you had. But I think it's just a matter of go ask. Why not just explore that, right?
Have the information. I can't tell you how many WGN listeners have come into my office and said, I'm sure there's nothing you can do for me, but can you just take a look? And then we wind up either reducing or eliminating their federal student loans or their private student loans altogether.
Financialrelief.com. Let's go to the phone lines, and we've got John on the air. Hello, John. How are you doing today?
I'm good, guys. Thanks for taking the call. I tuned in a little bit late, but I'm really excited by what I've heard. We have our daughter that is just about to launch into her freshman year at Iowa.
Congrats.
Thank you. I'm curious, if I heard right, there's a kind of a 10-year term if you're employed in the private sector or public sector, and a 20-year term if you're employed in the private sector. What happens if you were to switch from public to private at year 11 or year 8? In other words, you just change careers and you come out of the public sector and you start working in the private sector. How does that complicate things?
That's a good question, and it requires some analysis before you take out the loans. So what we can do is we can analyze, okay, when are you planning on retiring? Sometimes people take a break from the public sector. The nice thing is that the 120 payments that you need for public sector loan forgiveness don't have to be consecutive. So you could even take a break, right, from the public sector and go work in the private sector. And then you could put your loans into forbearance, and then when you go back into the public sector, pick up right where you left off to get that magic 120 payments that you need to get the loan forgiveness. So it just takes a little bit of strategy and analyzing, okay, what is the best way to approach this? Because you're right, if you only plan on working in the public sector for 5 years after your kids graduate, public sector loan forgiveness is going to be off the table. So then we know that we're looking at a different payment strategy and not public sector loan forgiveness.
Okay, and does the same kind of logic apply if for whatever reason your career is interrupted, you're laid off for 6 months or something like that. You use the term full-time employment. What happens if you're out of work for a period of time?
Right. Then we kind of have to go with the flow and figure out what's the best way to approach it. I would say in that situation, it might be a good idea to put the loans into forbearance, or we could even recalculate the payment to be $0 while you're unemployed.
Right, because you're making no income.
Exactly. So it's very flexible, and that doesn't exist with private loans. They don't care if you're unemployed. There's no way to recalculate the payment. The payment's the payment. So that's what's really nice about federal student loans. So then let's say something like that happens and you have an interruption in your employment. We can put the loans into forbearance for at least 3 years, sometimes 6 years, until you know what's going on. And then once you resume employment, then we can get you back on track, whether it's in the private sector or the public sector.
And last thing, I wrote down two things, financialrelief.com, and then it's the Federal Parent Plus program, correct?
Right. So you can go to studentaid.gov and you scroll right down to apply for Parent Plus loans, and we can certainly help you with that at the office too.
Thanks, John, and congrats to your daughter and going to Iowa. Good work there as a parent, of course.
It.
Yeah, for sure. Ray, we really appreciate you coming out. We've run out of time here today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
This has been great. Financialrelief.com. You heard John say it, doing the plug. I'll do it as well. Ray, we'll talk again soon, I hope, okay?
Yes, thank you.
This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I'm John Hanson. All right, Illinois Governor Pritzker signed a new bill into law on Thursday that bars police from lying to underage kids during interrogations. This was a bipartisan-supported bill that went through. This is the first state in the nation now. Illinois will be doing that. And here to chat about that a little bit is Laura Nyreiter. She's a co-director on the Center of Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern's Law School. Laura, thanks for hopping on with us here today.
Absolutely, John. Thanks so much for having me.
It's very rare we get bipartisan support for anything, so I like to celebrate it when we get it. But this bill was not only supported by politicians, but police associations as well, right?
That's right. Yeah, this is the first bill in the country, as you said, to prohibit police from lying to children during interrogations, which is a common sense reform that's long overdue. This bill was supported by folks from both sides of the aisle, also by the Illinois Chiefs of Police, by the Illinois State's Attorney Association, and by law enforcement trainers who train police all across the state how to question kids. So I'm so proud that this reform has really garnered, as you say, this rare moment of bipartisanship.
We should celebrate it when it happens. So when you just say the sentence, oh, yeah, they can't lie to kids anymore, I think a lot of people will go, well, yeah, of course not. They shouldn't do that. It's a little bit more nuanced than that, though, right? Because obviously you could have different interpretations of what lying is, what not. So I guess I want to ask from the beginning, what do you mean by lying? What has been done in interrogations that would qualify as lying that this bill now says you can't do that anymore?
Sure, absolutely. So this bill prohibits two specific interrogation tactics, both of which stem from deception, that have been used in Illinois and around the country for decades, right? These are psychological interrogation tactics that are designed, of course, to get confessions. The types of deception that this bill prohibits. The first category is lies about the evidence.
Okay.
So often when an interrogation is happening, right, you bring the suspect into the room, the police officer walks in and confronts the suspect with an accusation, right? We believe you committed X crime because we found your DNA at the scene, or we found your fingerprints on the gun, or there are three witnesses in the room next door who picked you out of a lineup. Those kinds of claims about evidence might be true, but they also might be false. Police are allowed to lie about the evidence against a suspect during interrogation. It's all part of the first phase of interrogation designed to bring a suspect down to a place of hopelessness. There's this mountain of evidence against you. You're trapped. You're cornered. No one will believe you if you say you're innocent, right? And then the second stage of interrogation kicks in, and this is the second category of deception that this bill is targeting. Once that suspect is brought down to a place of hopelessness, you're caught, you're trapped, you're cornered, there's this mountain of evidence against you, whether there actually is or isn't, then officers are trained to come in and say, well, look, you know, I can see you feel like you're in a corner. Listen, if you don't confess, people will think you're remorseless. No one will have any sympathy for you, right? You'll get the book thrown at you. The judge will dislike you. The jury will have no sympathy. And you're going to go down for life or some lengthy term of years.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do confess, people will see you're a good guy. People will see that you have remorse, that you want to cooperate, that you want to atone for what you've done. And in that case, maybe you just get a couple of years in prison. So it's these two categories of lies, lies about the evidence, and lies about the consequences of confessing.
Interesting. And this is for people under the age of 18. I imagine there's some people out there that would argue that this should apply to all adults as well. But this is a start because, boy, I think the tables have turned over the last 5 to 10 years, partly because of a case involving one of the folks that you've worked with, a high-profile case on Making a Murderer on Netflix. I think for a long time we thought if someone confesses, they are guilty, without a doubt. Why would anyone confess if they're not guilty? We've learned a lot in the last 10 years, haven't we?
We've learned a ton about this sort of fascinating question, right? Why would anyone confess to a crime if they didn't commit the crime, right? Especially something as heinous as murder, which you're right. My client, Brendan Dassey, whose story was profiled in the Netflix series Making a Murderer a few years ago, is exactly one such person. We know of hundreds of cases around the country in which people have confessed to crimes that DNA later proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that they did not commit. Here in Illinois, we have 100 false confession cases that have come to light so far. It's earned us the nickname, the false confession capital of the country.
Wait, so when you say we have 100, this means that these have been proven to be wrong by DNA or some evidence that show. It's not just, oh, maybe this is in doubt. These are ones that have been proven to be wrong.
These are That's right. These are proven false confessions, confessions that have been proven false by DNA testing, forensic evidence, fingerprint testing, whatever the case may be. So we know of 100 such cases here. And of that 100, 31 of those confessions were given by children under age 18. We know that kids are especially vulnerable to these interrogation tactics. They can't see through the deception, right? They're not equipped to understand when they're being lied to and when they're not being lied to. And we know that kids are between 2 and 3 times as likely to falsely confess as adults.
Why have these tactics been okay? I guess this is sort of a question of, I know a lot of people that would say, I cannot believe police officers have done this or detectives have done this, how incredibly bad this is. But this is how a lot of them have been trained, and it works.
No, you're exactly right. A lot of them have been trained to do exactly this. So, you know, back in the old days, about 100 years ago, right, when interrogations would happen, they involved physical abuse back in the day, right? People were just kind of roughed up, beaten up, whatever the case may be, until they got a confession. So about 75 years ago, in the 40s and 50s, a new set of psychological interrogation techniques was developed, actually, at Northwestern Law, which is where I now teach. And at the time, these psychological techniques, which revolved a lot around the use of deception, were thought of as really progressive and really enlightened because, of course, they replaced physical abuse. So those techniques developed in the 40s and 50s are still in use today, are still taught to officers all across the state and all across the country in all 50 states. But since the 40s and 50s, of course, right, something really important has happened. And that's the invention of DNA technology, because all of a sudden we can use DNA to test whether these confessions are true. And thanks to DNA, we are learning that people are falsely confessing at a rate much higher than anyone would have ever thought, and under circumstances that are different than we'd previously thought. It's these psychological interrogation techniques that are just as coercive, just as risky as the old physical abuse, the old third degree techniques that were in use 100 years ago. So this bill takes a huge step at eliminating the most risky psychological techniques, those that rely on deception, while still leaving in place other interrogation techniques that are proven to be more reliable in getting statements from guilty people. Right? We'll still be able to solve crimes, still be able to get confessions. We'll just eliminate this risky tactic of deception.
When you say risky, is it because you might get a false one, the killer or whatever, the person who did it, who actually did the crime, gets to walk free, and that could mean potential for other things? Does it save cities and states from potential lawsuits in the future? Like, I'm trying to see, like, why the Illinois chiefs would get, or why police would get behind this, because some people would say this takes a tool out of their tool chest.
Totally, right. It takes a tool out of the tool chest, but the problem is this tool carries with it a high risk of false confessions, and it's not needed to get statements from guilty people. That's why we got the support of the chiefs of police and the state's attorneys association. You know, when someone falsely confesses to a crime and is wrongfully convicted on the basis of that confession, that means that the real perpetrator is still out there on the streets. And, you know, we had testimony actually in the legislature in support of this bill from a man named Terrell Swift, a former client of ours at the Center on Wrongful Conviction, one of the so-called Englewood Four, a group of teenage boys who confessed to a murder that DNA 15 years later proved that they didn't commit. And in their case, turned out when that DNA was finally tested, finally identified, it belonged to a serial rapist.
Wow.
And murderer who had terrorized the Englewood neighborhood while these teenagers were languishing in prison. So, you know, at the end of the day, wrongful convictions, it's a public safety issue. Nobody wants an innocent person behind bars. Nobody wants the guilty person out roaming the streets. And that's why we were so proud to partner with law enforcement on this.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that assume the police just want, oh, they want someone in jail so that they can say, oh, we did it. And there might be some elements of truth to that, and there's circumstances where that's the case. But I think that 99% of police officers out there want the criminals that committed the crime to be the one in jail and not an innocent person. Laura, please stay on the line. We're going to put you on quick hold. And Carrie, stay on the line, too, because you've got a really great question. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. John Hansen here, hosting Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Association. Illinois, the first state in the nation to outlaw police interrogations of folks under the age of 18, at least for them to lie in a police interrogation, either about evidence or about consequences. Laura Nyreiter joining us from the Center of Wrongful Conviction from Northwestern Law School. And Laura, you don't mind if I take a quick call? We have a great question on the line. And this is coming from Carrie. Carrie, you're on WGN.
Hey, Jen. Hey, yeah, this is a really complicated question to discuss. I mean, just because now, I mean, just because you're a minor, you know, 12-year-old, 13-year-olds are doing really bad stuff.
Right.
But that aside, so rather than changing the legislature, wouldn't it be easier just to just require that a parent, guardian, or an adult relative or an attorney needs to be present before the police were able to even attempt this? That sounds easier to me than changing the whole, you know,
right,
making laws.
Or in conjunction with it. I mean, like, that could be...
Or in conjunction, yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Laura, any thoughts on that? Why isn't that required?
Well, I think, Carrie, I think you're spot on. You know, it's only about 13 states around the country, believe it or not, that require police even to notify a parent before questioning a child. And I say that as a mom of two boys, that troubles me to no end, and it should trouble any parent in the country. You know, Illinois did pass a law a few years ago, one of the first such laws, again, in the country, that requires lawyers in the interrogation room for kids, but only very, very young kids, 13 and younger, and only in the most serious of cases. So very few kids really are protected by this law. It needs to be expanded. Those two, I think, are common sense reforms that anybody who's a parent, anybody who knows a kid, you know, just understands how important that is.
Carrie,
seems like common sense.
Yeah, but you know, you can't always trust common sense in Washington or Springfield. So, Carrie, we appreciate the phone call. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Sean. Love it.
Absolutely, Laura. I wanted to ask: should this be the case? Should this law apply to adults too? Do you anticipate
Absolutely.
That happening eventually? Maybe.
Absolutely. It should apply to everyone, right? To everyone across the country. Illinois was the first. Oregon was right on our heels. Oregon signed a similar bill into law prohibiting deception with kids over there. And New York is currently considering a law as well that would prohibit the use of deception during interrogations, not just with kids, but also with adults. So, you know, I look forward to expanding these protections. We got to do it incrementally sometimes, which is fine. Let's get the ball moving. Let's show that we don't need these tactics to solve crimes, and let's expand these protections as much as we can.
I want to dive in just a little bit deeper, just in case, you know, just to really put a fine point on it. And I know you get asked a lot about Brandon Dassey, and feel free to use his example here too. But I mean, we're talking about getting confessions out of people where often police interrogators, to kind of fill in the blanks, they feed information to someone. I mean, that is a prime example. If there's one thing to show that someone didn't commit the crime, it's when they don't know any of the details of the crime.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's precisely what happened in the case of Brendan Dassey, as well as so many other false confession cases. They all follow a very similar pattern, right? So Brendan, who is, you know, again, in the Netflix series Making a Murderer, my client Brendan was 16 years old at the time when he was questioned back in 2006. He was a special education student with an IQ right around 70. And he's questioned four times over a period of 48 hours with no parents, no lawyer, about a murder that had taken place the year before. And the police, it's all captured on videotape and audio tape, every single word that transpires. And the police tell him, you know, they bring him into the interrogation room on the first go-round, and they tell him that the DA is looking at charging him with murder or having something to do with the murder, which was a complete lie, right? Mm. No one was looking at Brendan for anything because there was no evidence that he was involved. But they tell him that the DA is looking at charging him with murder. And they tell him, just as you said, John, that he needs to fill in the blanks. He needs to make himself look a little bad. And that if he does that, right, people will want to help him. He's going to be okay. He's going to be all right. He's going to have nothing to worry about. You know, the cops are going to make sure he's not left high and dry, so on and so on and so on. And, you know, you got a 16-year-old special education student there in the box, and eventually Brendan realizes that they want him to say he participated in this murder. And over the course of these four interrogations, you know, there's Brendan trying to describe participating in a murder and utterly failing. This is a tragic case. of a young woman who was killed by she was shot in the head. That's how she was killed. And the interrogators ask Brendan to describe, you know, this murder. And he guesses every which way you can think of killing somebody. Did we stab her? Did we, you know, punch her? Did we choke her? At one point, he's so confused, he says, well, we killed her by cutting off her hair. And he can't come up with the right answer, so they have to feed it to him. Brendan, you know, you shot her in the head. It's a classic, classic sign of a false confession. And frankly, you don't have to be a lawyer to recognize, you know, when that happens, when you've got a kid who does not know what he's talking about. Brendan, as I said, those interrogations were back in 2006 when he was 16. He was convicted on the basis of those confessions and nothing else in 2007. And he remains in prison, tragically, to this day. We got within about 12 hours of getting him out a few years ago.
Yeah, I remember that because he was
blocked it. Yeah.
Where does that case stand now?
We're still working on it, still fighting. You know, at the Center on Wrongful Convictions, we've exonerated about 45 people over the course of our history and gotten, you know, secured the release of dozens more. And we know that these cases sometimes take 5 years, sometimes take 10 years, sometimes take 15 years of legal work because the system is designed so much to keep those prison doors closed. And you are just, you know, walking up a mountaintop, up the side of a mountain to try and pry those doors open. So we are still working on the case every day. Still very much believe in Brendan Dassey, as, might I add, does the rest of the world.
Yeah. Laura, thank you for all your work. I'm glad that we are on the right side of this here in Illinois. Laura Nyreiter from the Center of Wrongful Conviction at Northwestern Law School. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate giving us some time here on the Saturday afternoon. That's going to do it for Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. News next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.